This is tape one, side one, of an interview with Professor Robert Byron Byrd in his office at the University of Wisconsin-Madison on October 1, 1998. The interviewer is James G. Cranham. Professor Byrd, I know from things I've read that you were born in Texas in 1924. For the record here, can you give me your exact birth date and tell me something about your early childhood?
Well, I was born on the 5th of February of 1924 in Bryan, Texas, where my father was a professor of civil engineering at Texas A&M University. And about a year later, we moved back to, the family moved back to Iowa, where my father had grown up, and where he had been born on a farm near Fort Dodge.
How long were you in Iowa?
You think this is going to work out all right now?
We'll try.
Well, let's see. We were there for about 4 years, and then we went to Memphis, Tennessee for a year. Then we came back to Fort Dodge, and then we went to Washington, D.C. for a year, and we came back to Fort Dodge again until 1936. And at that point, we moved to Washington, D.C., and I went to high school in Washington, D.C.
What took your father to Washington, D.C. at that time?
Well, he was a civil engineer, and he was working in the field of flood control and water treatment. And he got a very good job with the Corps of Engineers in Washington, and had a very successful and productive career there as a civil engineer.
What do you remember of your high school years in Washington, D.C.?
Oh, they're very wonderful memories. I went to a very fine high school there in downtown Washington, and I think the level of instruction was extremely good there.
Did your interest in engineering start there?
Not really. When I got ready to go to college, I wanted to major either in foreign languages or music. But my father didn't think that that was a very wise idea. He was afraid I wouldn't be able to earn a living that way. So he said, you're going to take engineering.
What foreign languages were you particularly interested in at that time?
Well, I had had 5 years of Latin and 2 years of French, and I had studied German on my own on the bus ride back and forth to school, and I'd also studied some Anglo-Saxon on my own.
Do you have any recollection of what prompted your intense interest in foreign language at that time?
I think it was because the teachers I had in foreign languages were exceptionally good.
That was in Washington, D.C.?
In Washington, D.C.
Your music interest, when did that develop?
Oh, I started piano lessons in Iowa when I was about 7 years old. And here again, I had a very fine music teacher in Fort Dodge, Iowa, and an excellent music teacher in Washington, D.C.
What particular expression of music do you find you have most talent for?
Well, my interests are mainly in classical music, and I do some composing now because my finger dexterity isn't what it used to be.
Were you primarily a pianist then? Or?
Later I took pipe organ as well.
You graduated from high school in Washington, D.C., and what did you do then?
I went to the University of Maryland as a major in chemical engineering.
So your father's influence was dominant on your choice at the time you went to college?
It was his choice.
Well, how did you find it once you were enrolled there?
Well, I did just fine. I enjoyed it. I think I always enjoyed going to school anyway, and so I did okay.
What do you particularly remember about your college days with your new major in chemical engineering?
Well, I started college in 41, and of course in December of that year the Japanese bombed Hawaii and the United States entered World War II. And so there was a cloud hanging over all of us at that time, and it was just a question. It wasn't a question of whether you were going into the armed services, it was only a question of when. And this made studying rather difficult, because if you think you're going to be yanked out of school in the middle of the term, why, somehow you don't put the intense effort into your studying that you should.
Well, surely you didn't falter on your academic success at that time.
Well, as a matter of fact, I did, because I was in the advanced ROTC program, and I knew that we were going to be called up, and so when the word came out, would come out that we were going to be called out in the middle of the semester while we all quit studying and just enjoyed ourselves. So the result was that my grades went down appreciably in the last two semesters that I was there.
How long were you at the University of Maryland?
I was there for a total of 2 years, a little less than 2 years, before I went into the Army.
How long were you in the Army?
I was in the Army for 3 years. So I went in in June of 43 and got out in about June of 46.
What were your assignments or responsibilities while you were in the Army? It connected with your engineering interest?
Not at all. Or any interest in language or music either, for that matter. No, I went in and took basic training in the chemical warfare service and then went on to officer candidate school, since I'd been in the advanced ROTC program. And then I joined a 4.2-inch mortar battalion as a second lieutenant. And almost right away, we shipped over to Europe in the fall of 1944.
And you were actually a gun-carrying soldier during the time in Europe?
Well, yeah, I had a carbine,
yeah.
And, but I was in charge of the fire direction center for the whole company of 4.2-inch mortars.
The war was over before you were discharged from the Army. What were you doing during that interim period?
Well, they had a rule at that time that when the war ended in August of 45, they had a system of points where you got a certain number of points for various types of service, and they let the people out right away who had above a certain number of points, and then they went down to the people who had fewer numbers of points. So I didn't have enough points to get out right away, and I had to stay in for another, I think it was until May the following year.
You were in the occupation forces overseas then?
Well, I was in the occupation forces in Germany from VE Day until about sometime in perhaps June. And then we came back to the States and we were at Fort Jackson, South Carolina.
Did you find that your self-taught German from earlier years was handy while you were in Germany?
Absolutely. I was the only officer in the company who knew both French and German, so I got pressed into service on numerous occasions in France and Belgium and Germany to act as an interpreter, even though my language knowledge at that time was not really adequate to function in that capacity.
But I'm sure that it was enhanced by the necessity of responding to those assignments.
Absolutely. I had somehow had the foresight to take along a pocket dictionary for both French and German, and I just about wore those pocket dictionaries out
when you were discharged in 46, what were your plans then?
Well, I knew I wanted to go back to college, but I felt that I needed a little bit of time to review what I had learned before I was in the Army. So I spent about 4 months in a biochemistry lab in the Department of Agriculture, a government laboratory in Washington. And that gave me a chance to do some laboratory chemistry work and get familiar with some kinds of chemistry that I didn't know before. I ran Keldols and a number of other routine measurements for the guys who were in charge of this laboratory. And then on the bus going back and forth, I studied some more German and reviewed differential equations and also reviewed some of the chemical engineering and chemistry topics.
Did you ever have thoughts of changing from chemical engineering at that point, since it had been more or less directed on you by your father?
No, at that point I was still quite definitely dedicated to chemical engineering.
Well, after doing this period of working in the laboratory and you're reviewing on the bus and otherwise, when did you resume your formal studies?
In September of 1946.
And where was that?
University of Illinois in Urbana.
How did you happen to make the choice to switch from your former school at Maryland to go to Illinois?
This is an extremely complicated story, but when I left Maryland, I had finished 5 semesters. When I was in the Army, I was sent back to Maryland for 1 semester on the ASTP program, and I took the 7th semester at that time. So after the war was over, I went to see the chairman of the Chem Engineering Department in Maryland, and he said, well, you're lacking the 6th semester and the 8th semester, so you'll have to come 2 years in a row in the spring. And I said, well, can't we make some sort of a deal where I can finish up in 1 year? And he said, no. So I started shopping around and found that there were plenty of schools who would be willing to have me come and finish up in 1 year, and Illinois was one of them. And I sort of wanted to come back to the Midwest.
Well, you did return to college at Illinois, and you graduated, and what then?
Well, then I had to... Well, I knew I wanted to go on to grad school because I had lived at the Alpha Chi Sigma house at Urbana, and at that time there were 40 grad students living there and 4 undergraduates. So I saw how much fun these grad students were having, and I decided that was for me. And I had also decided pretty much that I didn't want to continue in chemical engineering because in talking to the chem engineering grad students, it seemed to me that there wasn't enough novel in the graduate program at that time. It just seemed like it was more of the same sort of stuff we'd had as undergraduates. And so I started shopping around, and I had to make a decision between organic chemistry and physical chemistry because I liked both of these subjects very much. And one of the fellows living in the Alpha Chi Sigma house was Ed DeButts, D-E-B-U-T-T-S. And Ed had known Joe Hirschfelder during the war, and Ed himself was a physical chemistry major, and I liked him very much. And he said, oh, you ought to go to Wisconsin and study with Joe Hirschfelder. And my organic chemistry teacher there had been Bob Frank, and he had gotten his Ph.D. degree up here with Homer Adkins in organic chemistry, and he also was pushing me towards Wisconsin. So I came up here and took a look around and fell in love with the place, and so there was no, I didn't even apply anywhere else. I just applied to the one school.
When you entered at University of Wisconsin, did you have financial support, such as an assistantship or scholarship or something?
Oh, yes. I had a WARF fellowship. That's Wisconsin Alumni Research Foundation.
Did that require any particular duties of you other than just scholarly achievement?
It was for doing research with any professor that I chose to work with. So I interviewed around here. I talked to Farrington Daniels and Bob Alberti and Jack Williams, Joe Hirschfelder, and several of the other physical chemistry professors, and I decided that Joe was the most exciting one.
And when did you actually begin your research with him?
The first week. He put me to work immediately. He was a very hard taskmaster. We had to be in his institute every day of the week, including all day Saturday. And Joe was one of these people who went around and talked to each of his graduate students every day, and to see what we were doing, see whether we were experiencing any problems and so forth. He was an extremely diligent mentor.
What research did you undertake that first year?
Well, he put me to work along with another one of the students, Ellen Spotz, S-P-O-T-Z, and he put the two of us together on a problem of the calculation of the transport properties of dilute gases. In other words, the viscosity, thermal conductivity, diffusion, and thermal diffusion. And we were to make calculations of these properties using a reasonable intermolecular force law.
In those days, the calculations were a time-consuming, tedious operation compared to what they would be today with computers, wasn't it?
Absolutely. What took us a year or so to do could probably be done today in a week or less. But at that time, all we had was the Marchant and Monroe calculators. These were electromechanical devices that they cost about $1,000 a piece, mm-hmm. but all they could do was add, subtract, multiply, and divide.
Did you make any change in the research problem during your graduate study with Hirschfelder?
Oh, yes. I went on and worked on some other problems after that. Well, we continued some of this work into the second year, and then the third year I started to work on equation of state, the so-called virial equation of state, and it was my job to calculate the third virial coefficient using the Leonard Jones 612 potential.
And you were successful at doing that, I presume?
Well, I was successful at doing this, except just at the time I finished, I found out that a professor in Japan during World War II had made the same calculations, and he had done all of his calculations on a on an abacus. However, my calculations were somewhat more complete, so that saved the day.
Was that the principal focus of your dissertation then?
Yes, the third virial coefficient. I'm sorry, I misspoke on that. The Japanese work duplicated the work that I had done earlier with Ellen Spotz. The third virial coefficient, I found out about the time I was ready to finish, that had been duplicated in Holland by Jan van Kranendonk and Jan de Boer, his professor. And also there was another group that had calculated the third virial coefficient, but my work was much more extensive and much more accurate than theirs had been.
And that completed your dissertation work,
yes.
And you received your PhD from Wisconsin. And what did you do with it?
Well, during the time I had been a grad student with Hirschfelder, I had had a chance to meet many of the big wheels in the field of theoretical physical chemistry, because Joe Hirschfelder himself was a very well-known person. And so he was always inviting people to come here as visitors. And one of the visitors that I had met was Jack Kirkwood, who at that time was at Caltech. And another one that I met was Jan de Boer of the University of Amsterdam in the Netherlands. And I was quite impressed with both of these people, and both of them offered, well, Kirkwood offered me a fellowship, and I was able to get a Fulbright grant to go to Holland at the same time. So it was a difficult decision to make, because both of these gentlemen were absolutely outstanding in their field. However, the chance to go to Europe and study another foreign language was more than I could resist, and so I went to Holland to study with Jan de Boer.
Had you developed any facility with Dutch language before that time?
I started studying before I applied for the Fulbright grant. I got some books out of the library and just started to study by myself. Then later on I got a record course, and then after I was sure I had the grant, I hired a teacher, Hans Weinberg, whom you may know. He's an organic chemist at the University of Groningen in the Netherlands, just retired there recently. And Hans was my teacher for the summer, during the summer term before I
went. He was here at Wisconsin?
Yes, he was a graduate student also. And he was a terrific teacher. And I got a lot out of those private lessons.
So you had a good facility with Dutch language when you went to Amsterdam.
It was still rather halting, but I could certainly read things okay. And after I'd been there for several months, well, my conversational ability improved at a rapid rate.
You must have a real gift for language.
I wouldn't say it's a gift, it's a sickness.
How long were you in Amsterdam?
For 1 year.
And what was the nature of your work there?
Well, I was working at the Institute for Theoretical Physics, and I worked on two projects there. One was infrared absorption in homonuclear diatomic molecules. And then I did another project on quantum deviations of transport phenomena of gases at low density.
And when you completed that year of postdoctoral work in Amsterdam, you returned to the United States?
Yes, I came back to the University of Wisconsin because during the summer before I went to Holland, Joe Hirschfelder had decided that he wanted to write a book, and that later became Molecular Theory of Gases and Liquids. And so he asked Chuck Curtis, who had been one of his graduate students, and myself, and Ellen Spots to work on this book with him. And so we started to work on that in the summer before I went to Holland. While I was in Holland, I wrote two chapters over there with Jan de Boer, the director of the Institute for Theoretical Physics. So when I came back over here, while I was over there, well, the other three were here writing chapters of the book. And when I came back, well, we had one more year where we completely reorganized the material, changed a lot of the notation, and then prepared the final manuscript.
What was the source of financial support during that time you were writing the book?
Joe Hirschfelder had a grant from the Navy, and I was supported on that.
The Navy was supporting the writing of the textbook, or the grant was for other purposes of research?
The details of that I don't know. How Joe managed this is beyond me, but he that was his responsibility.
Yes. I just spent the year after your European postdoc,
yes,
working on the book as,
yes,
a co-author.
Yes.
The book was completed by the end of that year?
The major part of the manuscript was completed by the end of that year.
What did you do following that writing?
Well, I got in my car and with my few belongings and drove off to Ithaca, New York to be on the faculty of the chemistry department at Cornell.
You had gotten an offer from them in the meanwhile.
I had offers from Berkeley, Colorado, Texas, and Cornell. And I decided to take the one at Cornell.
Do you remember what particularly influenced your choice among those different prestigious institutions?
Well, I think the quality of Cornell influenced me. I thought Berkeley was a bit too far away. And also at Berkeley they wanted me to teach freshman chemistry. And at Cornell I was told I would be teaching physical chemistry. But unfortunately during the summer, one of the faculty members in analytical chemistry, I guess, had passed away, so I got shoved into analytical chemistry. I've forgotten the details of that, but in any case, I ended up teaching quantitative analysis, which was a subject I didn't like at all.
Well, you probably were able to bring some unexpected physical chemistry perspectives into the teaching of quantitative analysis.
Perhaps so, but I think the biggest thing that helped me there was Don Cook. Don Cook had joined the faculty there a year or two before, and he was an analytical chemist. And he very generously offered to help me get started in reading the right books and getting the right perspectives on the subject. And he was so enthusiastic about analytical chemistry and so kindly to me that I ended up actually enjoying teaching analytical chemistry. And I learned a great deal, mainly because of Don Cook.
Did you ever have to teach analytical chemistry again?
I taught it the second semester that I was there. And so I just taught for two terms at Cornell.
And then you were teaching physical chemistry all the time after that? While you were at Cornell?
Well, I was only there for two semesters.
All right. Yeah. So you were at Cornell for two semesters.
That's
right. And then what happened?
Well, a very strange thing happened on April Fool's Day of 1953. I got a telegram from Olaf Haugen, who was at that time the chairman of chemical engineering at Wisconsin, inviting me to come to Wisconsin to join the faculty here. And since it came on the 1st of April, and since someone had played a terrible New Year, April Fool's joke on me the year before, I thought this was another April Fool's joke. And so I didn't answer the telegram.
Did you think that it was one of your colleagues at Cornell that was playing the joke on you?
Oh, no. I suspected somebody here at Wisconsin who had pulled a joke on me the previous year.
I see.
So I didn't answer the telegram. I thought, well, I'm not going to fall for it this time. And then about 10 days later, I suppose, Joe Hirschfelder called me up and said, well, aren't you going to answer Olaf's telegram? And I thought for a moment, I thought, oh, was that for real? And he said, yes, of course it was for real. What did you think? So I told him I thought this was an extension of the joke that had been played on me the year before.
He knew about the previous joke?
Oh, I think he did, yes.
Yeah. Uh-huh. So after he assured you that it was for real, then you responded to the talk.
I responded right away, yes, because I realized I'd been quite rude.
Yeah. Well, did you have any questions about whether to make the move from Cornell or were you immediately ready to come back to Wisconsin?
I was in a terrible dither. So I came out here for a weekend, for a few days to look around, and Olaf Haugen gave me a sales talk and led me to believe that probably I would sort of succeed him as a with a specialty in thermodynamics and statistical mechanics. He realized that thermal was moving in a more molecular direction, more or less the direction in which John Proussnitz at Berkeley finally went. And so he wanted me to work in that area. And I found that a very attractive thing, because then I
side two of the interview with Professor Bird on October 1, 1998.
Okay, see, you asked whether it was obvious what I should do at that point, and the answer is that I was in a terrible dither. I really was enjoying myself at Cornell immensely. I had practice privileges on the Sage Chapel pipe organ on the Cornell campus, which was a magnificent instrument. I had made a number of very wonderful friendships in the chemistry department there, and so I really had no compelling reason to leave. I was quite happy there. Also, I wasn't sure that I wanted to switch fields again. I was quite happy in the field of theoretical chemistry and felt that I had a good future there. And on the other hand, I had had a wonderful time here in Madison, and there were forces that were pulling me back here as well.
At Madison, you had taking your degree in chemical engineering.
In chemistry.
In chemistry you did.
Yeah, here, yes. I had done my degree in chemistry here with Hirschfelder.
All right. But they were inviting you back to...
In a different department, yes.
Okay.
Now, fortunately, here at Wisconsin, the relations between chemistry and chemical engineering had always been extremely good. There were a lot of good friendships formed between the departments. Hirschfelder and Daniels were very good friends, and Chuck Watson in chemical engineering had done his PhD with Jack Williams in chemistry, and so there were tremendous friendships between the two departments. The two departments got along well together. At Cornell, on the other hand, there was tremendous enmity between the chemistry and the chemical engineering departments. And at Cornell, I had wanted to establish some connection between the two departments when I was there. And Frank Long, who was the head of the chemistry department, simply said, "Well, if I see you consorting with any of those guys, well, your job will be in jeopardy," or words to those effect, to that effect. And I didn't like that very much, but I managed to make friendships in physics and math as well as in chemistry. So I was in a terrible bind. I didn't know what to do. And so finally I made a list of all the things one should consider in deciding which job I should take. And then I had a column for Cornell and I had a column for Wisconsin. And then I gave weighting factors to each of these points, and I filled in the numbers, grading each university for each one of these factors. Then I added up the numbers, and Cornell won. Somehow I felt uncomfortable with the way this had come out, so I went back and adjusted the numbers, and I adjusted the weighting factors. And Cornell still came out ahead. And I carried this card around in my pocket with me for several weeks, fiddling with the numbers, and Cornell always won. And finally I realized that I wanted to come back to Wisconsin. And it didn't make any difference what those numbers were. That's what I was going to do. So I did.
Once read that a way to really decide the case is to flip a coin. And while the coin is in the air, you know how you want it to turn up. And you don't have to wait for the coin to come down.
Well, this was something like that.
So you did return to Wisconsin, yes, in the Department of Chemical Engineering?
Yes. But that was after I spent the summer at DuPont.
Oh, okay.
And that was a very important part of my
Okay, so you left Cornell, knew you were going to leave, and you,
yes,
took a summer employment at DuPont.
DuPont, yes.
What were you doing at DuPont?
Well, there I got introduced to the subject of rheology. I went into DuPont and found out that my boss was going to be Henry Linton, L-I-N-T-O-N. And Henry and I had been gone through officer candidate school together during World War II. So my boss was somebody I knew, and I walked into his office. He said, "Well, we're going to make a rheologist out of you." I said, "What's rheology?" I didn't even know.
Yes, that's understandable. Well, did you go to DuPont ostensibly as a chemist or a chemical engineer, or was there a distinction?
I think my title was research chemist, but there wasn't all that much of a distinction. In fact, well, Henry Linton was a had gotten his degree in chemical engineering at MIT, and Jim McKelvey, who later became the dean of engineering at Washington University in St. Louis, he was a chemical engineer, and there were a number of others there, so it was sort of a mixture of chemists and chemical engineers.
Okay, so you set out to learn a new language.
Uh-huh. I had to learn the language of rheology. And also, during that summer, we were reading proofs on the molecular theory of gases and liquids. So it was an extremely busy summer for me to work at DuPont all day and then work every evening until midnight reading the proofs of the book.
During the time you were reading the proofs, you were doing that on your own. You were not doing it as a group.
Oh, no, no. Yeah. I was down there, and Joe and Chuck were here. And by that time, I think Alan Spots had dropped out of the project, so there were just three of us at that time.
Well, at the end of the summer, you had learned the language of rheology.
Yes.
And completed the reading of the proofs. And
yes, almost.
Almost. And so you came to Wisconsin then in chemical engineering.
Yes.
And what did you set out to do at that time?
Well, I had this understanding that I would be teaching thermodynamics when I came here, and I was very happy with that idea. But during the summer before I got here, Bob Marshall had been moved up from this department to become associate dean of the college. And his specialty was fluid dynamics, mass transfer, and applied math. And so suddenly the department had no strength in that area at all, because he would not be able to teach and be associate dean. So immediately, Olaf Haugen threw me into teaching a course in fluid dynamics. And fortunately, during my stay at DuPont, I had been doing fluid dynamics of molten plastics. And so I was actually rather well prepared to step into that assignment, although that's what was not what I had expected.
Well, you had the perspective of practical applications of the study as well, that
precisely
you could bring
precisely
to the classroom experience.
Absolutely. I had some practical experience, and I had also had the experience of seeing that the chemical engineers working at DuPont on the projects that I was involved in down there were missing something in their training. Namely, they had not had sufficient training in the fundamentals of transport phenomena.
So you set about to add that to the curriculum?
Precisely. Right away I knew that there was something there that I could do to help strengthen the chemical engineering curriculum.
That was probably the perspective of a physical chemist looking at the area of rheology.
Well, it was I had the advantage of a chem engineering undergraduate training. I had the advantage of the theoretical chemistry graduate training, and I had the advantage of the short period at DuPont. And trying to attack some of these problems. So I really just lucked out in having the right background at the right time.
When you undertook the incorporation of these ideas and perspectives, did you feel that you were actually making significant changes in the direction of the department or of the field itself?
I don't think I really had that much of a feeling at that time. It was just that I felt quite strongly that this area called transport phenomena, which is a combination of fluid dynamics, heat transfer, and mass transfer, it's really a subject in classical physics. And I just had the strong feeling that that material should be covered by our undergraduates and also by our graduate students.
And that was an innovation for the time.
This was a definite departure from what had been done before.
Was there any resistance to making that kind of curriculum change?
Oh, yes. The first time I proposed this to the department, it was voted down. I wasn't too surprised because it was quite a departure from what we had done before.
Did the opponents just think that it was not really chemical engineering, or that it was getting too much on the applied side for the university, or what was the source of the opposition?
I don't know. I suspect if I had been one of the older faculty members and saw some young squirt come in and want to change the way things were being done, I expect I would probably have not been too enthusiastic about it. So what happened next was that Bob Marshall decided to start up a Department of Nuclear Engineering. I was put on the committee to formulate what this department would be, what its curriculum would be, what kind of faculty it would need. And the committee, in assembling the curriculum, decided that we needed a course in transport phenomena for these nuclear engineers. So I made up the outline for the course and the aims of the course and the subject material in some detail, and the committee adopted this. And then when the curriculum went to the Physical Sciences Divisional Committee, where it had to be approved, the committee there said, "Why isn't this course already being taught in chemical engineering?" So the thing came back to the department for action a second time, and by that time my own ideas had become better organized, and I had much more detailed material prepared, and so the course was accepted by a vote of 5-4. Also, at that time, we were having extensive discussions about curriculum revision. So that's how it happened.
Let's back up just a trifle.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes when a person becomes a faculty member in the same department in which that person received the PhD degree, there is at least a period of time when it is difficult for that person to be perceived as a faculty member instead of a continuing student.
Mm-hmm.
Perhaps you didn't face that problem because you took your degree in one department of Wisconsin and you returned to a different department, so I presume that that was not a part of the opposition to your new ideas.
No, I don't think so, no.
Well, when the proposal was finally accepted by a 5-4 vote, how did you proceed to develop the course?
Well, it was decided that the next fall we would put this course into the curriculum.
In chemical engineering rather than nuclear engineering.
Yes, nuclear hadn't started up yet. So it was up to chemical engineering to do the trailblazing work at that point. And Professor Ragatz was the chairman of the department at that time, and his feeling was, and the feeling of the other older members of the department was, that there should be a condition put on the startup of this course, namely that I would prepare an extensive set of notes so that the students would have something to work from and so that the teachers would have something to work from. And Professor Ragatz felt that everybody in the department should take a turn teaching this course if it was going to be part of our curriculum. And I think that was a very wise decision on his part. So at this point, it was clear that this was going to be a major undertaking to prepare essentially a textbook for a course with only a few months' notice.
There was no textbook at the time.
There was no textbook at the time.
Was there a similar course elsewhere, or was this really a pioneering effort?
This was a pioneering effort, although later we found out that there were similar courses being developed at other schools. Churchill and White at Michigan were in the process of developing a course. I think Fraser Johnstone at Illinois was toying with that idea. Joe Smith, who was at that time at Purdue, was thinking about such a course. Bob Pigford at Delaware, and Joe McCarthy at the University of Washington. There were all these people around the country who were beginning to have the same feeling that this type of a subject material was needed.
Sounds almost like some research that just comes to flower and being worked on in several different places independently.
Sure.
And
sure.
Unknowingly.
That's right. Well, it was an idea whose time had come,
yes.
As one says. And also, here again, I didn't know anything about, none of us knew anything about this, but there was even a committee of the ASEE, the American Society for Engineering Education, that had been formed to develop the syllabus for this course. We knew nothing about this, and we didn't know anything about these other developments going around the country. And I say we, I mean myself, Warren Stewart, and Ed Lightfoot, because those two colleagues had volunteered to work with me on this project. And that was also a tremendous stroke of luck.
What particular specialties did those two bring to the project?
Well, Warren Stewart had worked for five previous years or so at for an oil company in Chicago, Sinclair, I believe. And prior to that time, he had taken his Ph.D. at MIT in the chemical engineering department. And he's an extraordinarily gifted person, very, very bright, has, I think, a photographic memory. And he'd had all that 5 years' worth of industrial experience in addition. Also, his thesis had been in pretty much this area of transport phenomena. Ed Lightfoot had gotten his Ph.D. in chemical engineering at Cornell, and then he had worked for 3 years for the Pfizer company in New York City, which is a pharmaceutical company. And Ed is a person with fantastic energy, tremendous imagination. He knows how to challenge ideas and statements, and he's a little bit on the wild side, always wanting to sort of upset the apple cart, you might say. So these two fellows were tremendous colleagues, and tremendously, they brought whole new perspectives to this subject, which I did not have.
Were all of you of new faculty members same rank?
Well, Ed Lightfoot and I had come here almost during the same week, and Warren had come here 2 years after that.
So you quickly worked together and produced a textbook for the course to be offered in the fall.
We were turning out notes at a rate that was, I can't imagine that we did it. We turned out the notes, keeping ahead of where the class was, And we had a room in the basement where these notes were being assembled. and we would try to get them out in time for class. And also I ran a coaching session for the faculty members for whom this was completely new material. So the material had to be produced very promptly, and so I could have my planning session with the other faculty members as well.
So you didn't have the textbook ready when the course began, but you had evolving just in time.
This is very unusual. As you know, most textbooks are written after a person has taught the course for 10 years and feels that he knows something about it. Here were three rank beginners, really. We'd never taught the course before. We weren't even quite sure what the course was going to consist of, and as far as the details were concerned. So we were doing something that I think is extremely unusual.
Do you recommend it as a pattern?
I wish it could happen more often. But at that time, you have to keep in mind, there were no pressures on young faculty members to get grant money and to psych out the granting agencies and to publish or perish and travel and triumph and cash or crash. That whole mentality did not exist at that time in the 1950s in chemical engineering.
Do you mean that you did not feel that research output was part of your university responsibility?
Exactly.
Permissible, but not required.
Well, I think in this department at that time, it was more or less understood that teaching was the number one priority, and that textbook writing was a high form of teaching. Olaf Haugen himself was a textbook author, and Bob Marshall was a textbook author. And before Olaf Haugen, the previous chairman had been Otto Kowalke. He was a textbook author.
And of course in chemistry there was Farrington Daniels.
Farrington Daniels. So Wisconsin was fairly well known at that time, both in chemistry and chemical engineering, because of undergraduate textbooks which were very popular and very widely used.
Mm-hmm. Well, how did the course go under those unusual circumstances?
Well, let's just put it this way. We were exhausted by the end of the semester. We had produced a first draft of the main text material. Then in the spring, I taught in Delft, in the Netherlands.
Okay.
So I went off to the Netherlands on a Fulbright professorship and a Guggenheim grant. And during the spring term of 1958, I taught transport phenomena at the Technical University of Delft in Dutch.
How did you happen to take off from the University of Wisconsin so early in your career here? Was it a special leave? Or?
Well, I applied for this Fulbright grant. I wanted to go back to Holland again because I had enjoyed my stay there so much. But the first time, I just had to go back. So I already had that leave planned. So during the spring, I was teaching transport phenomena at Delft, and Ed and Warren were teaching, Ed Lightfoot and Warren Stewart were teaching transport phenomena here in Madison. And then we were both making up problems and illustrative examples to flesh out the text. And then...
Did you find it instructive for yourself to have to translate this new material into Dutch?
Oh, it was a tremendous challenge, and I mean, I really liked that. And also, I was interacting with a different type of group of students there and faculty, and so I got some good ideas there about what to include in the book as well. So by the end of the by June of 1958, then, we had a pretty good manuscript, and that was sent in to the Wiley Publishing Company. And over the summer, they prepared what was known as a preliminary edition of the book. It was just typeset, or just they typed it with an electric typewriter. And so that was then our textbook for the following 2 years. And during the following 2 years, we revised this extensively, and then the final book finally came out in 1960.
And it became a bestseller.
Not right away. In fact, there was a certain amount of skepticism among a lot of people, and we got rather mixed reviews on the book. But then gradually, I think, people began to realize that this idea had merit, and so little by little the book started to be used in undergraduate and also in graduate courses.
You mentioned the several other people and places where this type of course was being developed.
Yes.
Simultaneously with the one here at Wisconsin.
Yes.
But unknown to you.
Yes.
When your book did appear either in the preliminary or final versions,
yes,
did you find that those institutions were early on adopters, or
I don't know that I know the answer to that. It may have been that some of them used their own locally produced notes. I just really don't know.
But no other notes had become a textbook before yours did.
No. Well, the White and Churchill notes had gotten pretty far along, but that never materialized as a textbook.
Has there been any textbook in the field transport phenomena since yours was published?
Oh, quite a few. There are probably several dozen books now available.
But yours is still selling.
It's still selling. It's in the 57th printing.
That's amazing.
It's certainly lasted far longer than we ever dreamed that it would.
It either means that the field hadn't changed very much, which is doubtful, or the authors were unusually astute at seeing into the future.
Well, here again, I think it was a matter of luck. It was luck that the three of us with our three different backgrounds got together at just the right time, at just the right place, with the encouragement of Olaf Haugen. And without all this luck, it wouldn't have happened.
Mm-hmm.
Olaf Haugen really played an important role. Well, yes, he, as I mentioned earlier, was felt that our first obligation was to teaching. And when we started to work on the book writing project, he told us that we should give that project everything we had, and even if it meant neglecting some other departmental duties. He was a tremendous mentor and a tremendous colleague.
Well, I presume that book, long-lasting as it is, has been a significant influence on engineering curricula throughout the country.
I think that's a safe statement.
Yeah. And essentially,
I don't know whether the influence was good or bad, but
I presume that there is a course related to that text material in all in chemical engineering curricula now.
I think something like that, or I mean, this course has evolved in various departments in various ways, but certainly this kind of subject material is there now.
You indicate that there was a strong emphasis on the textbook writing early on in your days at Wisconsin that led to the successful production of this major textbook. Your publication record reflects that you have engaged in research unrelated to textbook writing. When did you feel that a shift, if any, occurred to direct your efforts toward original research output?
Well, here again, that traces back very much to my time at DuPont, because there I got introduced to the world of plastics and polymers and rheology, it became rather apparent that there were, at that time, very few people active in the polymer rheology field in chemical engineering departments in the United States, not more than three or four. So I finally decided that looked like a good area to do research in and challenge students with. So that's what I started doing.
Did you feel that there was any strong push from the administrative office? Tape 2, Side 1 of the interview with Professor Robert Byron Bird. You were speaking about your initiation of research activities that was prompted by your work at DuPont.
Yes.
Did you continue with what you undertook and where it led?
Mm-hmm. Well, you asked the question whether or not I had been pushed in this direction by any of the university authorities, and the answer is no. I've always felt that this university treated the professors very well in that they don't get involved in the in trying to shove anybody in any particular direction. So I started to work in this field, and up until 1968, I worked on what would be called the continuum mechanics aspect of the field. In other words, not the molecular theory, but the fluid dynamics, the thermodynamics, the continuum aspects of the subject. And this led me also to become a consultant for the Union Carbide Company. And for about 15 years, I was a consultant with them. And that contributed also very strongly to the direction of my research program and also the teaching in that area, because I would go out to Bound Brook, New Jersey a couple of times a year and spend time out there seeing the kinds of problems that they were working on. And maybe I shouldn't say this, but I think I learned more from them than they learned from me. It was, from my point of view, a very, very stimulating experience.
What were the major papers about that grew out of this research endeavor?
Well, there were papers dealing with the heat transfer in flowing polymeric liquids. There were papers dealing with the viscous heating effects in high-speed polymer flow. There were papers dealing with constitutive equations for polymers. There were papers dealing with the solutions of flow problems of various kinds, including solutions by variational methods. And those were the kinds of things I was doing. And as I say, this was stimulated very strongly by the work at Union Carbide.
Was the research financed in any way by Union Carbide or other industrial sources?
No. Carbide did not furnish research grants. By that time, I was getting research monies from National Science Foundation. I did have a...
So by that time, you had become part of the grantsmanship
I had
game.
Joined the grantsmanship crowd, although even then, at that time, the situation was a lot easier, and it was... You didn't have to write up such huge grant proposals. I mean, the grant proposals were a matter of several pages, and then after the grant was finished, why, the NSF wanted you to turn in a few pages telling what you'd done. And we didn't have to have special offices at the university to help you prepare your grants and do the finances and things of that sort. It was a much more scholarly sort of enterprise.
How many graduate students did you have at one time in this research work?
Well, I started out with just having a few, and then gradually I accumulated more. And by 1964, I think I had a group of about 10, which was too many. Particularly since in 1964 I became chairman of the department, and that meant that I didn't have really enough time to supervise that many students.
Mm-hmm.
And I also wanted to keep a hand in teaching, so the first 2 years of my chairmanship I was working way too hard. And then by that time, by 1966, we were beginning to have riots on the campus in connection with the Vietnam War, and I realized I was going to have to give up my teaching and spend more time on departmental and university affairs, and I turned over part of my research program to postdocs to let them co-direct some of the work, which also I didn't like to do, but I had to, because I spent the next 2 years then replacing broken windows in the building and trying to maintain a safe building, trying to keep the rioters out of the hallways, I spent a lot more time on these things at the campus level also, talking with the chancellor about protection of laboratories and things of that sort. It was really pretty hazardous for a while.
Well, the rioters focusing on the engineering building, or was it more general on campus?
Well, we have the engineering placement office in this building, and there were interviewers coming here from various companies like General Electric and Dow and some of the other companies that were targeted by the demonstrators, as you may recall. So this building was the focal point. And so we would have thousands of students congregating around the building or storming into the building. And what I didn't want to have happen was for them to cause an accident in one of our laboratories, or if some poisonous gas were accidentally let loose in the building.
Yeah.
I didn't want a lot of students to be killed or injured on that account. So we did have a considerable problem here in involving safety and relations with the campus authorities, with the police, and so forth. So for my last 2 years as chairman, from 66 to 68, it was a pretty rough time.
Were the protesters confronting the building and the occupants of the building more or less on a general basis, or did it seem to be confined to the times that the interviewers were here?
Usually involved specific companies, or when, for example, the intelligence people were coming here. What do you call them?
The FBI, you
No,
mean?
Not the FBI, the other one, the one that deals with the overseas.
CIA?
CIA, yeah, the CIA. I'm not very good on government initials. When the CIA would interview, or the FBI for that matter, well, then they would they would also be the target of considerable disruption.
Was there any damage more serious than a few broken windows? Or?
Well, we have the Sterling Hall bombing, which took place in around 1970, I believe it was, either 69 or 70. And that was when a van was filled with fertilizer mixed with fuel oil and parked over here between the chemistry building and the physics building. And that thing went off at 3 a.m. one night and blew all the windows out of the buildings in the middle part of the campus. And it caused the middle wing of the chemistry building to collapse. And it blew a hole about three or four stories tall in the physics building. And after that, the whole mood on the campus changed. I mean, there was a sudden realization that that was not the way to proceed.
Was anyone injured in that explosion?
One person was killed and one was injured. And several professors' entire research careers were, all their research results were just destroyed. It was one of our saddest moments.
Were the perpetrators of the bombing ever apprehended?
I believe ultimately three of them were apprehended, and the fourth one has never been heard from since, as far as I can recall.
Was the riotous disruptions that were occurring part of the reason that you discontinued being chairman in 68, or was it just that your term in the barrel had run out?
No, I had agreed to do it for 4 years. That was the dean at that time had sort of an unwritten rule that if you did the job, you had to be willing to do it for 4 years. If you wanted to do it for more, you could. But after 4 years of that, I was quite willing to let somebody else do it for a while. I found I was getting jealous of my colleagues who were teaching and doing scholarly things.
So you returned to those things that you enjoyed more than being chair.
Yes.
And did you return to more or less the same teaching assignments, or did you undertake new ones at that time?
I started to undertake some new things. I started teaching several new courses in polymers, a course in polymer fluid dynamics and a course in kinetic theory of polymers. And because my research then, I decided to take off into a totally new direction for me, namely the kinetic theory of polymers, the molecular theory of polymers. So here I was combining the sort of thing I learned at DuPont with the sort of thing that I had done here in graduate school. Here again, this was a very lucky choice and just at the right time somehow.
And this became a fruitful field of research?
Oh yes, very definitely.
Well, did it lead to any more textbooks or?
Yes.
Or what?
yes, I started, well, I had two students in right after I got out of the chairmanship. I had to build my research group up all over again. And I had two students, Robert C. Armstrong, who is now the head of the chem engineering department at MIT, and Ola Hassager, H-A-S-S-A-G-E-R, who is now a professor in Denmark. And these two students were my only two students for a couple of years, so I could spend a lot of time with them. And we really worked very well together as a team, and they were extremely gifted people. I should say they are both extremely gifted people, and both very hardworking, very cheerful, and extremely good scholars. And before they had finished their PhDs, one day they came into my office and with sort of a funny grin on their faces, and I said, "What are you guys up to anyway?" And one of them said to the other one, "Well, who's going to tell him? Which of us is going to tell him?" And I thought, "What on earth is this about?" And finally they said, well, they had something they wanted to talk over with me. They wanted to write a book with me. I said, "Are you sure?" And they said, "Yes, your class notes for this course that you teach, we like them very much, and there's nothing like it in the literature. So we'd like to help you produce a book out of those notes that you have." So I spent several hours with them telling how much work this was going to involve, what sort of a time commitment would be involved, how much pain would be involved. And after that they said they still thought they wanted to do it. So I said, "Well, then the next thing we have to do is write an outline, see if we can agree on an outline, see if we can agree on the scope, the aims, the level." And so for the next several weeks we worked on this. Mind you, they still didn't have their PhDs yet. So by the end of the semester, we had pretty well settled on what we would do, and then they both stayed over during the summer as postdocs, and we started producing manuscript. And then within about 3 years, we had this book finished. By that time, Bob Armstrong had gone on to MIT, and Ola Hassager had gone back to Denmark. So we were doing a lot of this by mail. Then,
did you have some grant money to support them during that summer there, or?
I guess I must have.
Or they were counting on big royalties in the future.
No, I think I must have made use of grant money on the ground that much of what we were doing was, in fact, research.
The
book was still in the distance, and we had to shape some of this material in the proper form for textbook. And then when we got along toward the end of this process, I realized that we were really making a great deal of use of things I had done together with Chuck Curtis over in the chemistry department. He and I had been teaching a course jointly on some of this material, so the other two co-authors agreed that we should ask Chuck to join us, so then he became the fourth co-author.
And that book was then published, and
yes.
What is its title?
Dynamics of Polymeric Liquids, Volumes 1 and 2. Volume 1 is Fluid Mechanics, Volume 2 is Kinetic Theory.
And who was the publisher of that?
That's Wiley also. That came out in the first edition in 1977, and then we put out a second edition in 1987.
Were all four co-authors involved in the revision?
Oh yes, very definitely. Ola Hassager came over for one semester or 1 year, I've forgotten now, but he came over from Denmark and spent some time here working on it. And then I would make trips periodically to MIT to work with Bob.
Is this book used primarily for graduate courses, or?
Yes. Either graduate, well, the second volume, definitely graduate courses. Volume 1 can be used for seniors and graduate students.
Is it widely adopted?
Not terribly widely, because that field is, that's fairly, that's a rather special field, polymer fluid dynamics and polymer kinetic theory, so that book never achieved the success that the first one did. But it's, I think, been influential in the research area.
Well, that involved research you were doing in the 70s. What did you do following that? Did you switch fields again?
No, because the 80s, we kept on working in kinetic theory of polymers, and then all that work went into the second edition of the book.
Mm-hmm. Well, this has been career of considerable achievement and interplay of your industrial exposure, your teaching mm-hmm. sense and obligations. It's interesting that your research exposure led you into the transport phenomena, wrote a textbook, continued doing research in that. Mm-hmm. When you switch fields to kinetic theory, you sense the need for another textbook. Mm-hmm. It's been this interplay. It's a Do you sense that this has been a very fruitful way to do your professorial duties?
Oh, yes, I obviously do. I think that every profession needs to have responsibly written textbooks and monographs. And I think that the people who write those should be people who are, in fact, actively engaged in research, so that they are up to date and go to meetings and know all the other people in the field. And I think those are the kinds of books that we need. And also, the other thing is that one, I think, gets a great deal of satisfaction from is producing textbooks in areas where there haven't been any before. You're collecting together an enormous amount of material that's scattered all through the literature. It's hard to find, and it's always in different notations with different viewpoints. And if you can bring this material together with standard notation, uniform notation, uniform viewpoint, and summarize not just your own work, but the work of everybody else as well, then you can contribute enormously to the advancement of the profession.
You indicated that early on in your career at Wisconsin, you sensed a very definite encouragement to produce such textbooks.
Yes.
And you did so.
Mm-hmm.
Do you find that the now young members of the faculty are oriented in that direction or not? Is the textbook tradition of Wisconsin continuing, or has it waned a bit?
Well, I'm afraid it's going downhill here like it has at other places around the country. Our young faculty members are expected to write grant proposals, account for the finances. They're expected to be very productive. They're expected to go to meetings. They're expected to network with similar faculty members at other schools. And, you know, this doesn't leave very much time over for textbook writing. So we have not been as prolific, I think, as probably we should have been. Now, we've had Harmon Ray, whom you met earlier this morning, has written two books since he's joined the faculty here. And Dale Rudd wrote several books during his period of tenure here. We have one young faculty member downstairs who's currently working on two textbooks. And then we have another faculty member up on this floor who's working on a textbook.
That sounds like quite a list of textbooks in the making.
Well, I think we're maintaining the tradition, but perhaps not to the extent that we did before.
Do you think that the list you just cited is an indication that there is a return to the emphasis on textbook production in the department, or has it more or less been this level all along?
Well, I think we've had this tradition in the department, starting with Kowalke and then Haugen and Watson and then Bob Marshall and then my colleagues and myself, and this has sort of kept going. And I think because there is that tradition here, that it may be easier to maintain it here than it will be to build it up at other schools where the tradition does not exist anymore, or never did exist.
How do you find the student changing over your career? Do you find much difference, or do you see them differently?
Well, I suppose I see them differently because I've grown older.
I mean, in terms of their preparation, their readiness for education.
Well, I think, by and large, we have had just wonderful students here at Wisconsin, both undergraduate and graduate students. our undergraduate students are made up primarily from students who come from small towns and farms around Wisconsin. And they've got both feet firmly planted on the ground, and they're willing to work hard. They've had good home training. They've had good encouragement from their families. And they've been a real pleasure to work with. Our graduate students come from all over the world, and they are also, many of our graduate students were the top people in their classes in the schools that they came from. And so they're a very lively group, and they challenge one another, and they work well together with each other. So my own feeling is that I couldn't have asked for more as far as students to work with here, both at the undergraduate and graduate level. As far as their background is concerned, we have noticed a definite decline, I think, in the basic training in mathematics, physics, and chemistry. There's been, a decided deterioration over the past, say, two or three decades. Maybe let's say two decades. And on the other hand, the young people now know a lot more about computers. They're much more computer literate than previous people were, because there weren't any big computers then. So I think overall they're still a very fine group of people, but I wish the high school training were better.
Do you find that there has been a noticeable shift toward or away from chemical engineering and student choices during your career?
Well, of course, we went through a very low point in engineering enrollments in the 1970s, probably, after the in the wake of the Vietnam disruptions. The students in that period tended to get away from the hard sciences and drift over to the social sciences and political science, economics, social studies. And so we did in the 1970s, the enrollment went way down. In the 1980s, the enrollment went way up again, to the point where we were just inundated with engineering students. In fact, our department, I think, raised the admission standards up to something like a 3-point grade point average, or maybe even 3.25 for a while, for admission to the junior year. And then after that, then the enrollment went back down again. I think now it's about where it should be.
Do you have any other comments about your career at Wisconsin itself before we go on to other topics?
Well, I, as you know, I've had sort of a dual career here in chemical engineering and foreign languages. I just, as I told you earlier, I have a sickness for foreign languages, so. In 1963, I had put out jointly with a colleague in the German department named Bill Schetter, S-H-E-T-T-E-R. We put together a Dutch reader based on selections from modern Dutch literature. And this book was quite successful. And Bill went on to teach at Bryn Mawr and then to the University of Indiana, and he's now the president of the American Association of Netherlandic Studies. He's become one of the grand old men in Netherlandic Studies, and I consider it a real privilege and a pleasure to have been able to work with him and to learn more about linguistics and language and literature. And then later on in 1985, we put out a second book on second Dutch literary reader. And once again, I'm just very grateful for having had this chance to work with Bill on that book, because I learned even more on the second time around, because I was much more sensitized to some of the problems of language and literature.
He was a native Netherlander, even though he was teaching in the German department here?
No, he was an American. He got his PhD at Berkeley, and his specialty was Dutch. And he came here and he taught German because there was no Dutch program here. And then he went on to found the Dutch program at the University of Indiana, ultimately. And at the same time, I worked very hard here at Wisconsin to get our Dutch program established in the German department. We now have two full-time professors over there who handle the Dutch program, and they're doing a splendid job. And I just am very pleased to see how they've taken hold and how well the department has treated them.
But your Dutch Reader book that you published, just selections of Dutch language literature, or did it include instruction in the elements of language itself?
No, these were readers, because Bill Schutter had already published a grammar book himself, and that's been probably the most successful Dutch grammar book. It's gone through many, many editions, and so our books were intended for second-year students.
Okay.
And then the reason we put out the second book was that we felt that we needed to have a new book with newer literature in it, with more modern authors represented. And also we wanted to expand it to include Flemish literature and literature from Indonesia and the ABC Islands in the Caribbean. And so the first book was then allowed to go out of print, and the second book then took its place. But by that time, we were beginning to develop a lot of competition. There were a lot of competing books out there, and so that book has now, I guess, gone out of print. It lasted about 10 years.
Is there another Dutch reader from you apt to appear?
I don't think so, because as you know, the next thing I did was to get involved with Japanese.
Tell us about that.
Well, in 1961, I went to a meeting in Japan it was the 25th anniversary meeting of the Japan Society of Chemical Engineers. And then the following year, I was invited to spend a whole year, that was 62-63, in Japan as a visiting Fulbright professor. So I spent a half a year at Kyoto University and a half year at Nagoya University. And I took private Japanese lessons when I was there and worked very hard at the language. But by the end of the year, I wasn't able to read technical things, and I wasn't able to have technical discussions with my colleagues. And I felt terribly depressed and terribly upset and disconcerted and disappointed.
Could you by that time handle non-technical conversation, grocery store shopping, that sort of thing?
Oh, yeah, to a limited extent. I mean, I could get around because I had learned the grammar pretty well by then, and I had a reasonable daily life vocabulary, so I was able to get along. But I felt so bad that I couldn't function in connection with the technical language. So when I came back to Madison, I started making systematic studies of the kanji. Those are the Chinese characters that are used in Japanese. I started making an intensive study of these to find out what the distribution was of these characters in the technical language. So I took a physics book, high school, high-level high school physics book,
And I went through and I counted the number of times each character appeared in this book. And so I could have a build up a frequency diagram and know which characters were the most frequent and which ones were the least frequent. And what I found, to my amazement, was if you knew 300 out of the total of about 3,000 of these characters, if you knew the right 300, you could read 90% of a physics text. And so later on, I joined together with Ed Daub, and a Japanese professor in Tokyo, and the three of us put out a book called Comprehending Technical Japanese. And this was a technical reader, the idea was you could use this technical reader and learn what these 300 important characters are, and then get trained in the art of reading technical Japanese. So this was intended as a second or third year book for students of Japanese who want to go into the direction of reading technical material. And Ed Daub was the senior author of that book, and because he had spent something like 10 or 11 years in Japan. And then after that book came out, he became the director of the Technical Japanese Program here at Wisconsin. So we actually founded a new field here, and he became the director of that. This was the only university to start up a program of that type. And then later on in 1990, we put out a second book called Basic Technical Japanese, which is a grammar book designed specifically for people who want to go into reading technical Japanese and who don't want to know anything about conversation at all. They just want to aim towards a very narrow goal. And both of those books have done quite well. I think the first one's in its fifth printing, and the Basic Technical Japanese, I believe, is either in the second or third printing. And since our pioneering effort here, why, other schools have started up technical Japanese courses.
Is your textbook used in those other institutions?
I believe it is. I don't have any of the sales figures on this. I do know that we now have, well, Ed Daub is now retired, and his successor is Jim Davis. And Jim Davis now gives the course by television. And he has been training people at the Chemical Abstract Service in Columbus by means of a TV hookup, as well as people in a number of industries who also want to learn how to be competent in technical Japanese translation.
So as a very new faculty member here, you had significant input into changing the curriculum in chemical engineering. Mm-hmm. And as a result of your own travels to Netherlands, mm-hmm. you had an influence on getting a Dutch program established in the German department mm-hmm. here. Mm-hmm. And as a result of your stay in Japan, you had an influence in getting a Japanese program established at the university.
Mm-hmm.
What other departments have you started up at the university?
I think that's all. Isn't that enough?
That's enough. That's more than usual, certainly.
Well,
but it is interesting that your own keen interests as they develop, extending your own competences outside of chemical engineering, are registered in what happens in the university. You have found it a very receptive place for your own interest outside of your specialty.
Yes. I should add here, too, that in these language hobby interests, I have the full support of the administration on this. When I started to work on the Dutch project, the first one, I went to the head of the chem engineering department, who was Professor Raggetts at that time, and asked him if he had any objection to my spending part of my time on this. And he said, absolutely not. He says, as long as you do your work in chemical engineering, why, it's perfectly fine if you want to do that. Then when I started up the work on technical Japanese, Bob Marshall heard about this, and he said, look, if you produce anything you'd like to have published, we'll turn it out as a report from the engineering experiment station. He says, I encourage you to work on this. He says, I think that's an important thing to do. And then later on, when I got a campus-wide professorship, I wanted to spend part of my time then doing either Dutch or Japanese, and I had to check that out with the chancellor. I went up to see the chancellor and asked him if there was any problem if I diverted some of my funds to this hobby, and oh, he was very enthusiastic about that. So at every step, I've had an enthusiastic support by administrative officials, and I know there are some universities where that sort of thing would not be tolerated.
Well, I've been waiting, but I haven't heard you say you've had a similar impact on the music program at the university.
No, I'm afraid I haven't.
But you did mention that you're doing some composing now.
Well, that's just a hobby.
That's it.
These are little musical exercises. I just have to do something.
But they haven't been public. You performed?
Not really, no. Mm-hmm. I sometimes play them at our department Christmas parties, where I have a captive audience.
Yes.
I think maybe they would rather I didn't perform.
Well, I doubt that, but it sounds as though your fingers are not so stiff that you won't undertake such performances yourself.
Well, I can assure you that this is pretty rudimentary music, and my performances are not what you'd call stellar.
Well, you've had very strong encouragement at the university and have had an illustrious career here. And I believe it's been recognized by awards and memberships and other kinds of organizations. Tell us about those.
Must I?
Well, it would help the record be complete at this time. Don't be modest. This is recording for people to get the complete picture of what a university professor really is.
Well, in the first place, I think you know as well as I do that receiving awards and recognition is a matter of luck to a very large extent. And
you have to have friends that will nominate you.
Yes, you do. And you have to have colleagues who are supportive in those efforts. But luck plays a lot. I mean, I've served on a number of awards panels myself, and gosh, you know, you have one slot you're trying to fill for an award or a membership in an academy or something like that, and for every one of these awards that you can make, there are 10 or 12 others that could just as well have been the recipients of these awards. So I tend myself not to put too much emphasis on those things.
But just for the record, which one do you take most pleasure, private pleasure, in remembering?
Well, I don't know that I take private pleasure in these things. I'm happy for the department and the university that we get recognition that way. I mean, you don't, when you get these awards, there's nothing you can do with them. They don't make you feel any better. You can't buy anything with it.
But it is nice to have peers acknowledge you've achieved.
It's nice to know that something that you've done, often with colleagues and co-authors, it's nice to know that work has been favorably received. I think the two of the honors that I've had that have meant a great deal to me for personal reasons were receiving an honorary doctorate from Delft in the Netherlands, because I had a lot of friends there. I had some very good friendships, very solid friendships, in my knowledge of the country and the institution itself, it was sort of like a homecoming party, and sort of like a, oh, it just gave me a very comfortable feeling, a very warm feeling to have that kind of recognition. And then the other one was the honorary doctorate from Kyoto University several years ago, because here again I had taught there, and we've had people from Kyoto University spending time here, and I've maintained my connections with those people, and here again I have some very, very wonderful, I formed some very wonderful friendships with those people. And so going back to Kyoto and in that sort of a, for that sort of a ceremony was a, it was very heartwarming, very nostalgic.
Were the honorary degrees at both of those institutions awarded in such a way that all of the speaking associated with it was in the native language pertaining to each university, or did they spill over into English?
No, the one in Holland was completely in Dutch, and I think the one in Japan was completely in Japanese.
But you could understand completely both of them?
The one in Dutch, yes. The one in Japanese, was, the language was so flowery and so so complex, and that I'm sure I missed a great deal of that.
They were using different figures for the flowers.
Well, yes, but I mean my knowledge of Japanese is rather limited to the technical part of the subject, so I don't have a very big vocabulary for formal spoken Japanese.
Well, I believe you received an award from the Rheology Society, didn't you?
Yes.
That was for your research achievements, or was it primarily for your textbook, or just general leadership in the field?
I believe that was before the textbook came out, so that must have been for my early research work.
And you were elected to the National Academy of Engineering, I believe.
Mm-hmm.
And do you recall what year that was?
It must have been 1969. It was the fifth year that they elected people to that academy.
Mm-hmm. And subsequently, you were elected to the National Academy of Sciences.
Yes.
It's rather unusual, isn't it, for a person to be in both of those academies?
Oh. Well, Ed Lightfoot is a member of both of those academies, and there are about, it seems to me there must be about 80 or 100 people who belong to both of them.
Both of these have, at least as part of their mission, advising the United States government,
mm-hmm.
scientific and engineering matters.
Mm-hmm.
Have you participated in that way in the academies?
No, I don't think I have been asked to do that.
Yeah.
And I haven't particularly pushed to do it.
Mm-hmm.
I guess I am more of a scholarly hermit than I am a committee person.
Any other honors, awards that you wish to mention?
Well, the see, I'm an honorary member of the both the Dutch and Belgian Academies of Science. Here again, that means a great deal to me because of my association with the Netherlands, and less so with Belgium. But here again, that was very wonderful to have this chance to see old friends again, and to maintain the connections and the friendships.
Is your father still alive?
No, he's, after all, I'm nearly 75.
Yes.
It would be rather unusual.
Well, yes, but it may be possible.
No, he passed away in 1971.
So he was alive long enough to see the fruition of his firm direction of your career choice.
I suppose so, yes.
I'm sure he was proud that you had done so well.
Yes, I think he was. I think he... I think I turned out better than he expected.
Did you have any siblings?
Yeah, I have one brother, yes.
What area did he get directed
into?
Well,
he worked for the Ling Temco Vought Aircraft Corporation in Dallas, and he retired in 1987, I guess it was. He's younger than I am, but he retired before I did.
Mm-hmm. During your career, you have been a member, I believe, of AICHE, mm-hmm. and have been elected a fellow of that organization. Mm-hmm. Is there anything in particular you would like to record about your association with AICHE? Your participation in the organization or its meetings?
Well, as I mentioned earlier, I'm not much of a committee person or a meeting person, but I go to AICHE meetings probably once every 2 or 3 years, and I've served on a couple of committees. One of them was called the Dynamics Objectives of Chemical Engineering. That was a committee back in the 1960s, I believe, that was put together to try to determine what the future directions of the field might be. And that was a fairly interesting committee to be on, mainly because of the people that I had a chance to meet there and interact with.
I would imagine also it'd be a subject in which you took a great deal of interest, since you...
Well, I guess I enjoyed going to those committee meetings, mainly because of the people,
mm-hmm.
and how much influence our final report had, I really don't know. I think more gets done when a few individuals sit down and do it, rather than having a committee sit and deliberate.
Have you held any office in AICHE,
no.
Local or national?
No, I don't think so.
Mm-hmm.
Not that I can remember.
I'm sure you would remember. But you have been asked, you told me last night, to present a paper on history at an AICHE meeting
yes.
This fall.
That's correct. Mm-hmm.
Do you have any particular feelings about... change in chemical engineering during your career, or as you look back over even before you started in the mm-hmm. field, what's the principal mm-hmm. shifts you find in the field?
Well, I think the field has undergone an enormous change. When I was an undergraduate, the emphasis was on unit operations, and particularly the unit operations of the petroleum industry. And Haugen and Watson's books were very strongly influenced by K.M. Watson's work in the petroleum industry. That was the industry in which the science was being most extensively exploited, and it was a big enough industry that they could afford the research and the exploitation of science, of the basic science. And of course, the nowadays, which is by that I mean 60 years later, the chemical engineers now are going into a much, much broader range of industries. Petroleum has ceased to be the main field in which our graduates are being hired. We have people now going into surfactants and detergents. We have many going into microelectronics. We have others going into the biotech area, which of course is really blossoming, as you know, at the present time. And We have others going into polymers and plastics. That's been another big area. So there's been this tremendous shift in the subject material and the companies into which our students are moving now. The second thing that's had an enormous impact has been the development of the computer. The computer, of course, has made possible the implementation of a lot of theory, which before 1950, say, was just theory. You couldn't do anything with it. You couldn't calculate. It was too complicated. But nowadays, as you know, our beginning graduate students can make fantastic calculations and simulations and graphic displays that are mind-boggling to those of us who grew up in the 1940s and 50s.
Yeah.
Back when we took mechanical drawing and descriptive geometry
and punch cards with knitting needles was considered a very significant advance in literature collecting.
Yeah, well, that was back in the late 40s and early 50s that we were doing punch cards. And, my own thesis back in 1950 was done with punch cards and a whole bunch of IBM business machines, you know, regular accounting machines. My whole thesis nowadays could be done in an afternoon. Terrible to think how I wasted my time, isn't it?
Are you having any difficulty, or are your students having any difficulty finding employment these days, or...?
Well, keep in mind that I retired over 6 years ago, so I haven't really been following the employment picture recently. I have not heard from my colleagues of any crisis in this area, so I presume that they're being successful.
You mentioned your retirement, but we are holding this interview in your office in the Chemical Engineering Building at the University of Wisconsin. What is your continuing relationship with the department after retirement?
Well, I suppose officially it's up to them, but I come to the office every morning, usually between 6:30 and 7.
You must be one of the earliest arrivals.
The chairman is often here by that time. As you know, chairmen have to get in early and stay late to get their jobs done. But usually I am one of the first people here. The first 2 years after I retired, I swore I was not going to do any more teaching and that I was going to really enjoy being retired. Then in 1994, 2 years after I retired, I accepted a visiting professorship in Delft again. And I went back over there and taught a course in kinetic theory of polymers. And then while I was there, I was invited to come to Belgium and lecture there in the fall on transport phenomena at the University of Louvain-la-Neuve. And so I did that. And about that time, I think people were beginning to wonder why I didn't just stay home and teach. And so while I was in Belgium, I had an urgent message from the chairman saying that they were shorthanded for the next semester, and when I got back to Madison, would I be willing to teach again? So I did that. And then they asked in the fall, would I be willing to do it again? And so I've been teaching ever since, although not always both semesters.
Cute. Teach what would be considered a full load, or you teach one course?
I just teach one course, yes. And of course, I have no committee work. I don't go to department meetings. I don't have to fill out forms. I don't have to write grant proposals. So it's an idyllic life.
Well, I hope that it's arranged in Wisconsin so that you can lead this idyllic life, but not totally as a volunteer, that in spite of retirement that they are able to pay you for your part-time teaching. But so you do teach every semester now? Or?
I've had a few semesters off since I resumed my teaching duties.
Yes.
And I really enjoy it. I mean, it's such a wonderful group of students, and the last couple of years I've been teaching the graduate course in transport phenomena, and so that's material that I'm very familiar with.
Do you use your textbook?
Oh, yes. And as a matter of fact, we're rewriting the book.
Right? Oh, you are revising.
Yes, we're revising. The book is still in its first edition.
Yes.
And we're now preparing to put out a second edition, so...
All
three authors are involved, and we're hoping that we can finish this over a two-year period. So between the textbook writing and the teaching, plus the fact that I'm doing some research with Chuck Curtis over in the chemistry department, that keeps me pretty busy.
It sounds as though it's hardly what most people consider retirement. About the only thing you retired from is making out exams.
Well, that's true. It's been as I say, it's an idyllic life. I'm doing all the things that I really enjoy with colleagues whom I really enjoy.
That's
and
wonderful.
With students that I really enjoy.
Good.
What could be nicer?
That's right. And in a lovely environment.
In a beautiful environment.
Yes.
That's right.
What do you think of it? This is tape 3, side 1 of the interview with Professor Berg on October 1, 1998. Professor Berg, during your illustrious career, I'm sure you had opportunities to move from Wisconsin with enticing offers from other prestigious institutions. I believe I read somewhere that you had had such offers, but you decided to stay here. Do you remember what factors particularly made you decide to stay?
Well, I guess I haven't thought about that for a long time. But
not all of your colleagues at Wisconsin did stay.
That's true.
Professor Johnson moved to Stanford.
That's true.
And you had a similar offer, but
yeah.
You decided to stay. I was wondering what?
Well, I guess I have too many friends here, and I've enjoyed being at Wisconsin. And I like the countryside around here, and I like the opportunities for canoeing and hiking, and I just generally like the Midwestern way of life. I don't think I could be happy on the East and West Coast, and the South Coast would be too warm.
So it is, in effect, non-chemical engineering factors that played the major role. You found the chemical engineering situation a happy one here, and the geography added to that happiness, so no need to move.
That's right. Plus the general feeling of collegiality on the campus, and the good relations between the professorial staff and the administrators. We've had some very fine people here in the top positions, and I appreciated that.
Are there any in particular you would like to comment on or not?
The administrator?
Yes, sir.
I think probably we ought to leave that out of the discussion.
Okay.
It has no real direct bearing on chemistry.
All right. Well, perhaps that's a good comment in itself, that they have not been detrimental to your endeavors anyway.
Actually, some of our best administrative officials have been chemists. Conrad Elvian was president of the university shortly after I got here. And then one of our best chancellors so far was Irving Shane, analytical chemist. And one of our best deans of the graduate school was Bob Bach, who was a biochemist.
There was another chemist, Norm Cromwell, who was a vice chancellor mm-hmm. at the University of Nebraska for mm-hmm. several years. Mm-hmm. And I once heard him remark that he thought chemists made very good university administrators mm-hmm. because they were always glad to go back to chemistry. They had somewhere to go back to. And some persons from other disciplines didn't seem to have anything to go back to, so it was important for them to yeah. preserve their administrative position.
Well, actually, I've always figured that chemistry is a big field. It's very complicated. It's very messy. It sprawls all over the place, and chemists are brought up to deal with this tremendous diversity of problems, and a lot of problems that are frankly insoluble. And I think that's that tends to make them good administrators. They're willing to tackle the insoluble problems.
When I was graduate dean, I noted that over half of the graduate deans in the country were chemists.
Mm-hmm.
That's certainly a disproportionate representation.
Yes. There's another reason for that, too, I think, and that is that chemists understand the importance of having well-functioning laboratories in many, many departments. And if you get somebody in as graduate dean who's never done any lab work, they have a terrible time trying to appreciate the needs of the experimental sciences.
You just mentioned a moment ago in response to the other question about canoeing and hiking. Are those your principal hobbies?
Well, my principal hobbies are probably languages and music, but I like very much the out-of-doors, and Wisconsin is always beckoning with its out-of-doors. We have beautiful rivers to canoe on here and a lot of lakes to go swimming in. And we're also not all that far from some of the finest canoe country in Canada. And I go up to Canada every summer and spend anywhere from 2 to 6 weeks canoeing on the lakes and rivers up there.
Are you packing your gear in the canoe with you to camp in wilderness areas?
Yes, that's what we do. Our canoe trips are usually 2 or 3 weeks in length, and we take all our food, our tents, sleeping bags, and all the other equipment that you need.
You say we. Is this your research group or a group of other canoeing enthusiasts?
Well, it can be other faculty members. It can be graduate students. It can be friends in other departments. Just anybody who's willing to go out and put up with the mosquitoes, the rain, the portages, and that sort of thing.
Are you the principal organizer for these outings?
Well, I've organized my fair share, but I've also gone on trips where other people did the organizing.
Do you think of anything that we've left out of the account that you would like to record at this time?
Not at the moment, no.
Well, I want to thank you for being very generous with your time and information about your illustrious career. It's been fascinating to me as an interviewer to hear you talk about it.
You've been a great interviewer, too.
Thank you.